This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to Landmark Women. We've got an amazing crowd again this month, and we did last month, and I'm starting to worry I won't be able to fit you all in the lounge. So I don't know how to solve that problem. But it's so wonderful to see so many people supporting the program and the speakers, the amazing speakers that we have come to talk to us about their incredible lives. I'd like to introduce you to Monica Lindemann, who will introduce you to Professor Anstey. Monica is the head of development at the National Museum of Australia and my boss, so it'd be nice to her. Monica?
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This has been a topic that has obviously captured a lot of people's interest. When Professor Anstey was announced as a speaker, a lot of my colleagues thought, oh, well, I really must get along to that because dementia and Alzheimer's is something that's touching a lot of people in our community. I'm absolutely delighted to introduce to you Professor Karen Anstey. I'll just read some of her wonderful achievements. She's currently the director of the Research Centre for Research on Ageing and Health and Wellbeing and director of the Dementia Collaborative Research Centre at the Australian National University. Her research interests include cognitive and brain ageing, chronic disease and mental health, prevention of cognitive decline and dementia, lifespan approaches to mental wellbeing, and the impact of cognitive decline on productive ageing. She currently leads the Path Through Life project, which is an epidemiological study focusing on identifying risk and protective factors that influence mental health, cognitive decline, and brain ageing from early to late adulthood. Some, and I say a very few, of her awards and honours include being selected as one of Canberra's 100 Women of Influence in 2013 as a centenary event. In 2010, she was the advisor to the Governor-General on priorities in aged care. In 2008, she was invited to participate in the Australia 2020 Future Summit, convened by Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. And in 2005, she was awarded the Margaret Bolts Award in Social and Behavioural Sciences from the American Gerontological Society. Excuse my pronunciation. At a personal level, Professor Anstey has lived in Canberra for about 13 years, moving here in 2001. She's married and has three children amongst her many achievements. Please join me in welcoming Karen to the stage.
Thank you very much for that introduction. It's a great pleasure to be here and quite an honour to be a speaker in this series on Landmark Women. Okay, I thought I'd begin the talk today with just some of my biographical details and some of my personal life story before I move into talking to you about my research areas and dementia, which is I know is a topic that has attracted many people here today and is of great interest to all of us. So just a bit about me. I was born in 1965, so I'm 49. I had three brothers. I was educated in the public system in Sydney. I went to the University of Sydney and, first of all, studied philosophy and religious studies. And during that time, I also had some very boring jobs, which were quite motivating for me to continue my education because I decided that I did not want to end up a clerk. Just pushing paper all day. I also worked as a proofreader for a record company and in the art department of a record company doing a lot of layout and decided, no, I wanted to do something more with ideas and research. So I then went on and I had my first position after my degree in the humanities was in publishing. And I also worked as a writer, a technical writer and a professional writer for Westpac Banking, and I also worked as a freelance writer. And I must say that those experiences as a writer have really stood me in good stead throughout my career. And in fact, probably what I do most, if you looked at my use of time, is write. As an academic, you write all the time. I also write for the media. I write for Medibank Private Magazine. I've written for the New York Times. I write for documents for public policy. So writing is extremely important in terms of communicating. And I think as a scientist, being able to communicate what we do is absolutely essential. So I think often these early experiences that you have when you're sorting out your career, working out what you want to do, end up contributing to where you end up in ways that you don't expect them to. But when I was working in publishing, I thought, I actually don't want to be publishing other people's books. I'd really like to be writing the books myself and doing research myself. And I realised that studying psychology would give me the research skills that I needed to do that. So I went back and studied psychology. Did my psychology honours at the University of Sydney, and then I got a job which really determined the direction I would take in my career. And that was a job as a research assistant in the eastern suburbs of Sydney on a project looking at falls and fractures in older women. And for this project, I had to knock on the doors of every house in some of the suburbs, such as Coogee and Clovelly, and I don't know if members of the audience know that part of Sydney, the little old terraces and in the apartment blocks, and I had to find women aged 70 and older and see if they would participate in our study. And then I'd get to interview these women, often over long cups of tea and homemade cake. I'd hear about their lives and I'd invite them into our laboratory for some physical assessments. And this job, which I had for about a year, turned out to be extremely influential. Until then, I'd never even thought about ageing. I'd never thought about, well, you know, as an area of study or really considered ageing. And what the job showed me was just the diversity of the women and their experiences. And I found it absolutely fascinating. And it really is what started me on the journey that I've followed up until today. So I think what was most interesting to me was the fact that I could interview three or four women who were, say, aged 80 within a week, and they were all just completely different. So some were sort of still extremely physically active, some were non-active, just socially, personality-wise, in terms of their relationships, everything. They were just so different. So I realised that chronological age was no indication of how well somebody was functioning, and that we needed a better way of talking about ageing and a better way of assessing people's individual capabilities. I went on to do my psychology honours on this very topic, looking at biomarkers of ageing. I then got another job that was also extremely influential in determining where I've ended up today, and that was working with Professor Henry Bradati, who's a very leading dementia expert, and he's the person that established Alzheimer's Australia. And set up the first memory clinic in Australia. And I worked for him for a year studying dementia, working on research projects related to dementia, and that's what sparked my interest in dementia. So all of those early experiences contributed different elements. I then went to the University of Queensland and did my PhD in cognitive ageing, again looking at that issue of functional age, again with older women. I assessed 300 older women for my PhD and again found that it was how they were functioning that was more important than their actual chronological age in determining their cognitive abilities. Whilst I was finishing my PhD, I had my first child. I moved up there with my husband. We had our first child, Jasper, and was going to do a postdoc in Adelaide with Professor Mary Lute, who's turned out to be a wonderful career mentor to me throughout my career, and that's another influence I think that's extremely important that many of us have experienced are these people or mentors that we meet throughout our journey. However, my brother became quite ill, and we decided that it was, rather than moving back to Adelaide, I would try to transfer the postdoctoral fellowship to Sydney so I could be near my brother as we were unsure what was going to happen with him over the next few years. So I conducted my postdoctoral research at a medical research institute near the Prince of Wales Hospital in Sydney. Again, looking at these issues of ageing and what makes people age well. And whilst I was in Sydney, I had another child, Felix. And that's when I really hit the issues that women face in science. I had two children, I was on a postdoc salary, and my childcare bill was almost as much as I was earning. I had no future prospects in my career because a research career in Australia, you're on a fellowship that ends and then you've got to get another fellowship that also will end. The government had cut, I think it was 14% off the higher education budget in 1997, which was the year I completed my PhD, and they'd axed a number of tenured academic positions, so there were very few academic positions being advertised. So I was in a career with, at that particular time, very few openings. And I think I went through what most professional women go through, that real crisis and questioning about how or what should I do. Am I absolutely crazy trying to do this with two children? I'm not making any money. It's killing me. It's such hard work. I'm trying to compete with men that don't have children. I'm in a very competitive environment. I went through a lot of self-doubt. I actually decided during my second lot of maternity leave that I would leave science because it was too hard. The scheme that I was on with an NHMRC had no maternity leave provision. This is in 2000. So I applied to a special committee that they had because there was no policy on maternity leave. I took maternity leave on my own fellowship. By the time I'd got back to work after 6 months, I got a letter from them finally saying that I was allowed to take some maternity leave. This is 6 months after the baby had been born. And then what happened was I won quite a prestigious award in science in my area, and Professor Tony John from the ANU wanted to recruit me here. And I went through that process of, well, you know, I nearly gave up. I'd put my name down with some private companies to go and work in the private sector, which would pay a lot better and offered better job security. But I thought, well, I'll sort of give it a bit longer. And the family moved to Canberra, took the position at the ANU, which was another contract, and we kept going. My brother actually ended up dying. He had MS. He died in 2002. And that was also another experience that has influenced my career and trajectory. MS is a neurodegenerative disease. I study dementia, which is a neurodegenerative disease, and there are similarities. I must say MS, it affects the body a lot more than dementia. There's a lot more disability leading up to the end stages. And any experience like that obviously influences people quite significantly. I did often wonder, and still sometimes wonder, why I didn't end up going into MS research, because I had such a personal reason to go in that direction. I was so far into my career in cognitive ageing and dementia at that point that I wanted to consolidate and stay in that area, but there are a number of similarities between the two. I think with early onset Alzheimer's, which often impacts people in their 30s, so there's about, I think it's about 30,000 Australians with early onset Alzheimer's at the moment. They go through similar processes. With watching my brother's illness, he had to have a lot of care. It impacted on the family. So there are a lot of similarities in caring for someone with a disease such as dementia. He had respite care. We had to arrange that. It's quite unique, arranging respite care for someone who's young compared to someone who's old, given most of the facilities are designed for older people. Things like the music that's played, lots of little tiny things that you start to see from a young person's perspective. So I think that experience as a consumer myself has really enriched me as a person, and in terms of my work in dementia, I can see the perspective of carers and consumers by drawing on that particular experience. In Canberra, we had our third child, Eloise, the ANU has just been a fantastic place to work for me and for my career, and I haven't, you know, had any more of those moments of wanting to, wondering whether I'd made the right decision and whether I should throw it all in. I think I'd have eventually accepted and been able to keep going as a woman in science. The ANU is a fantastic place. It's a beautiful physical environment. It's a fabulous intellectual culture. It's very international. It's a place where there's a lot of excellence. You work with good people. It's a very inspiring place. There's a lot of intellectual depth in all the different areas in the ANU, and it has been an absolutely fantastic period of time for me to be able to spend here. And just as a national university, I'm very proud to be part of that. I haven't got the ANU template on today. I'm actually speaking as me, so that's definitely coming from my own views. In 2010, I had the opportunity to take over directorship of the Dementia Collaborative Research Centre at the ANU, and that centre focuses on early diagnosis and prevention. And that's an externally funded centre, funded by the National Health and Medical Research Council, so it's not a permanent fixture. Again, it's one of those soft money things that could go. The ANU also established a permanent centre in its structure focusing on ageing in 2012, and I'm now a director of that. That's the Centre for Research on Ageing, Health and Wellbeing. So that's the bio stuff, my biography. So I think as an academic, and I'm sure other academics would probably agree with me, although I haven't actually talked to them about this, I have my fundamental questions that motivate me, and in fact they haven't changed throughout my whole career. One of the interesting things about preparing this talk was actually realising that I have the same questions now that I had when I started. So first, when I had that first research assistant position, why do people age so differently and how can we measure ageing or age? I still find that absolutely fascinating. What causes normal cognitive ageing? So we all have a decline in our memory and our thinking as we get older, unfortunately. Why does that happen and what could we do to slow it down or even reverse it? As I've learnt more about ageing from a demographic perspective, I've realised that the demographic change that we're in the midst of at the moment with population ageing, combined with what I know about cognitive ageing, has a major impact, and I'll explain that to you as I proceed through the talk. And that's led me to my current research, which is how can we prevent or delay dementia, and that's really where my passion lies at the moment. This is just a bit of light relief from my talk, showing you some pictures of women, all older women. They all look completely different. And just to make the point that we all age extremely differently. And the differences between us actually become greater as we get older. I'd also like to point out the picture here in the bottom right-hand corner, which I expect many of you have seen. It's actually it's used internationally as a sign to indicate elderly people. Now, whilst it's a very useful sign, there's some things about it which I think are quite interesting. I think it actually encapsulates what we call an ageist stereotype, unfortunately. It depicts older people as sort of stooped over, dependent on a walking stick, the woman behind the man sort of leaning on the man. And it communicates very clearly and well, which we need, but often these types of stereotypes are embedded and internalised by us and create negative expectations about what it's like to grow old. And that is something which we're doing research on at the ANU, and there's other groups internationally doing research on. And I think that is something that we all need to address as a society. And it impacts on everything, whether we're looking at dementia or whether we're looking at healthy ageing. There's actually research now showing that people who have more negative stereotypes about ageing don't do as well after a heart attack. They're less likely to be physically active. In some situations, they don't even live as long. So these negative stereotypes I carry them in myself. I often catch myself saying or thinking something that's an ageist stereotype, because as a culture, we have a very negative view of ageing. I just wanted to highlight that. That's the sort of side stream of research that we're conducting. So in some of the work we've done looking at ageing, this is going back to my early research in my postdoc, and I was interested in people ageing differently. And I've focused most of my career on physical ageing, but in this work we looked at psychological ageing, and we did find that people who had a lower sense of control over their own life didn't live as long. So this is in the Australian Longitudinal Study of Ageing, based at Flinders University. We followed people for 8 to 12 years, and we found people who on a questionnaire said they had less control over what happened to them actually didn't live as long. So in this figure here, I'll just try to explain, this is the days that people survived. So this is the people who had low control. And similarly, we looked at morale, and people who had the first assessment rated their morale as low also didn't live as long in the study. And the people who had the highest morale, most hopeful and positive about life, actually lived the longest. So there are, as well as a lot of the physical and health characteristics that I focus on most of the time and will tell you more about, it's true that psychological characteristics have a huge impact on how we age and our health. So I just want to move on to cognition because that's been the main focus of my research. So cognition is quite a fascinating area. So when I say cognition, I'm talking about thinking skills. So your memory, your verbal ability, your knowledge of words, your processing speed, how quickly you can compare bits of information, how quickly you can select out important things in your environment or important facts. These are a few tests. This one on the top left-hand corner is a test of your reasoning ability. It's a fairly typical IQ type test. This is a test of processing speed, and in this test here you have to pick out the word from the non-word, which is a test of your word knowledge. As psychologists, we have lots of tests we quite like, all these different tests of cognition that we give to people. And that's what these are our measures that we use to look at cognition. We also have some more practical everyday types of tests as well. So in normal ageing, so all of us here are ageing, there is a normal decline in cognitive ability. So it's normal for your memory to decline with ageing. And that's apart from dementia, which is a disease. So there is this normative change. The most common complaint we get in ageing is the tip of the tongue phenomenon. Knowing the word but can't remember it. So I get that. From about the 40s onwards, and that's normal. Everybody just about gets it. It usually resolves within 24 hours. Usually. Yeah. And there's sometimes a particular name that you really have trouble with. I have that. So there is this normal ageing. So that's what I've been really interested in. What is this? What causes this normal cognitive decline? We just did a national survey here of the Australian Diabetes and Obesity and Lifestyle Study, which is a national study of Australia looking at diabetes and obesity that I'm involved with. And this is the memory score. This is done in 2012. The memory scores just plotted by age for across Australia, and they just gradually go down with age. So this is a 16-item word list that people did. So that's normal. That's what happens in the population. You can see that if people live longer, they're going to run into significant cognitive problems eventually if they're declining. This is more, this is processing speed in the same study. And this is typical as well, where we find their verbal ability actually improves with age. And we tend to find older adults are better at verbal skills, so crosswords, much bigger vocabulary. We regularly will find in our laboratory that older adults do much better at all the verbal type of tests, because that accumulates over your life course. And similarly, professionally, so that's probably why judges tend to be older. You develop a body of knowledge, and that doesn't, in normal, if you're quite healthy, that's not affected by ageing. So you actually improve in your profession and professional knowledge over time. So you've got it. We have normal cognitive ageing. Now, this is the next fact, which is really important to understand, and in terms of understanding the dementia epidemic. So I want to talk to you next here about life expectancy and what's happened to us, say, since I was born or over the last 100, 150 years. If we look at, this is UK data, but it's almost exactly the same for Australia, except Australians live longer than the Brits. And so we have a couple of years extra in our life expectancy. So if you take 1965, that's the year I was born, males lived till about 67, which is what we now have for the age pension. So if you think about pension age, I don't know what the pension age was then, but it was probably still in the 60s. It wasn't such an issue financing the older population. And women, the life expectancy at that time was in the early 70s. So this is only in 1965. It's not that long ago. Then if you go up to 2000, this is again in the UK, so Australian numbers are actually a bit higher. The life expectancy at birth of women was 74.8, and of men and of women was 80, and that's only in 2000. And it's continued to go up. So this is a global phenomenon. It has happened across the world in developing countries and in developed countries, that life expectancy has risen dramatically over the last 100 years. And that has some major impacts. It explains why dementia has become such a problem. So when you see my next few slides, we'll put it all together. What you can see here is if we look at, this is Australian data, this is the growth of different age groups over time, and the group that is going to increase the most in Australia is the 85 plus age group. So because we have population ageing, we're going to see the biggest growth in the oldest cohorts, and the composition of the Australian population will change, as will other countries. So I'm going to move now on to dementia and spend most of the rest of the talk on dementia and explain why population ageing impacts on dementia so much, or why dementia impacts on population ageing. So who gets dementia? Anybody and everybody gets dementia. There's been presidents, there's been film stars. It doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. It doesn't matter what country you live in. A dementia is... it can strike anybody. It's very wide, very common and widespread. I'll just give you a bit of a definition. Dementia is actually an umbrella term. So that describes the symptoms, and there's a number of different causes of dementia. So the issue with dementia is it's a progressive, irreversible decline in your cognitive abilities, so those thinking skills. It can be caused by Alzheimer's. So Alzheimer's causes 60% of dementia. It can be caused by vascular disease, so small strokes, but it can be caused by Parkinson's, it could be caused by HIV, it could be caused by other viruses or conditions, alcohol dementia, for example. It's acquired, so it's not something you start off with. It persists, and it involves multiple impairments, not just memory. So to get the formal diagnosis, if you just had memory, you'd have amnesia, but dementia requires more than one impairment in one area of intellectual functioning to be impaired. So what's the prevalence? So this is where, if we think back to population demographics, when life expectancy was much lower around here, the prevalence of dementia in the late 60s is actually very low. It's less than 1% of the population. So when men lived on average to the late 60s, it wasn't an issue. Dementia really becomes prevalent up in the 80s and 90s. And so that's why we have the epidemic now, because the people are living so long. So we're moving into an era where we still don't know a lot about living into the 80s and 90s and over 100. We haven't done enough research. It's quite a new phenomenon as a society to have so many people living to these ages. In history, we've never experienced this before. So it presents a lot of opportunities as well. But you can see the prevalence. This is averaged across multiple studies. The reason we have lots of lines is that different countries look at their frequency of dementia and they use different methods. And so what researchers do is they look at all different studies and try to draw an average across studies. So they're always just estimates. We can never be 100% sure, because we're just trying to get all the data and go, look, it looks like about 25% of people in their 80s have dementia. If you look worldwide, the burden of dementia is actually higher in low- and middle-income countries than in high-income countries. So dementia is a huge problem in developing countries. It's not just in wealthy countries. And because of the huge populations in some of those countries, the sheer numbers of people with dementia are going to be enormous. These statistics are put out by international organisations, the Alzheimer's Disease International, just to give you a grip on the economics of dementia. Annually, dementia costs $600 billion, which is greater than the economy of Walmart or ExxonMobil. Dementia is also an industry. It's an economic industry. It costs so much. There's so much money in care and in drugs for dementia, that it's a force. It's not just a disease. It's actually an economic force now internationally. So back to here, local statistics, just to give you an idea. There's more than 320,000 Australians living with dementia. These are Alzheimer's Australia statistics. It will increase to 400,000 in less than 10 years. If we don't have a major breakthrough, so we still have no cure for dementia, and it doesn't look like there's going to be one soon. So without prevention, we expect there'll be nearly 900,000 Australians with dementia by 2050, and there's about 24,000 Australians living with younger onset dementia. So that's dementia that starts before the age of 60. Another way of looking at the figures is different ways, you know, what statistics are like. 3 in 10 people over the age of 85 have dementia, or 1 in 10 people over 60. It depends which way you want to divide the pie up or talk about the numbers. And at the moment, there's an estimated 1.2 million Australians involved in caring for someone with dementia, which means, you know, either you or someone you know is caring for someone with dementia. That's how common it is. And often the symptoms are noticed quite a long while before a diagnosis. So there's often that period of uncertainty, which I'm sure many of you have experienced as well. Just more on the personal journey of dementia before I talk about my own research. I think it's useful to sometimes try to imagine the experience of having dementia by looking at the way others have shared their own experience. And I find these sorts of documentations of experience very inspiring for my own research. So this is a painter, William Ultermolen, who had Alzheimer's disease. So these are some paintings that he did before he was ill. His wife was an art historian, so she's actually documented his journey with Alzheimer's. When he was diagnosed in the mid-1990s, he decided he would paint his journey with Alzheimer's, and he did self-portraits all the way through. This is him when he was a young man, a self-portrait. He is an unusual because, I mean, there's many books written about by people caring for someone with dementia or people with dementia, but there's quite a lot of art by people with dementia. This actually depicts his own experience, so it's quite personal. And for him, he found it was an experience of fear and isolation. And his wife interprets this painting to depict that. And he himself said that his work was about anxiety. So for him as an artist, the experience of having Alzheimer's disease was one of anxiety. And this shows you the progression, so him trying to paint himself. And there's quotes where he talks about knowing what he wanted to paint but not being able to do it, or looking at a painting and knowing there was something wrong with it but just not being able to work out what it was. So he had incredible insight into the progression of his own disease and was able to express that in a way and share that with us. And I think that there's a lot more of these paintings, and you can find out about him online on various websites. But it really gives you an insight that you can't get any other way, just looking at his expression of his own journey. And I find this extremely valuable and inspirational in terms of motivating me in my work, as do others. So I guess moving on to the research that I'm doing now at the ANU, obviously, the values that you have, that, you know, I guess they come from your family and from life experiences and choices that you've made yourself. And with research, I've always wanted to do something that was going to make a difference, and clearly dementia is an area that needs a lot of research, and my background in cognition and ageing is perfectly suited to research in that area, so that's where I'm focusing. And so what I've done a lot of work on is identifying risk factors, measuring the risk factors, and bringing the findings to the public and to policymakers. So that's another very important component for me as a scientist. We're also developing some interventions to help people reduce their risk of Alzheimer's disease. And I also conduct research into driving because I want to optimise mobility for older adults, keep them driving as long as possible. So one of the things that I've been doing is sifting through the literature to identify risk and protective factors for Alzheimer's disease. So that's been going since about 2005, and we've published in, you know, peer-reviewed journals the findings on the different risk factors for Alzheimer's disease. And through that work, we've actually developed now a questionnaire, which you can do yourself online. We've published the questionnaire, and now we've developed a website that anybody can go online and assess themselves on and work out ways they can improve their risk profile. The motivation for this risk assessment tool was to get something that didn't involve a medical test. So you don't have to have a blood test, you don't have to have a brain scan, you don't have to be genotyped. This is specifically designed as a public health instrument that will be free, because not everybody can afford to go to expensive medical clinics and have expensive testing done and get access to high-level interventions. The other reason we did this was because prevention has to start early. You need to know your risk factors when you're in midlife or early, even early adulthood. It looks like with brain ageing and Alzheimer's that the pathology actually accumulates over decades. So you can feel well in your 40s and 50s, but your brain could be accumulating Alzheimer's pathology. That's what we know now. We need to look at prevention much younger. So, again, people aren't going to be going to their doctor and asking about Alzheimer's in their 40s. So we've tried to design some tools and instruments that can be used by people who are younger, who are perfectly healthy, but can educate them on how to reduce their risk of dementia. So that's this self-assessment tool. I'm just going to now tell you about the content of that tool and what the risk and protective factors are. That's the URL on there if anybody is interested in going assessing themselves. You just type that in and you can then do the questionnaire. It will take you about 10 minutes. There's an option of having a PDF emailed to you of your results that you could take to your GP or just keep for yourself. Or you don't have to, you can just read the results that pop up for you online. So it will say things like, you know, you're doing well, but you could benefit from being more socially engaged, for example. It'll give you very practical advice. I'm just going to go through the risk and protective factors for you. So risk factors for Alzheimer's. Now, these are only the ones for which there's very good evidence. There's a number of risk and protective factors that are being researched right now. Our instrument only includes things that we're fairly sure about. So obviously being older increases your risk. Being female increases your risk. You can't do anything about those two things. Having had a head injury, again, you can't do anything about it now, but we can as a society implement policies to reduce head injury in sport. Being a smoker will increase your risk. Not drinking is actually associated with increased risk of Alzheimer's disease and dementia. That does not mean, I know, everyone loves that one. It doesn't mean that we recommend go out and start drinking because we still don't understand the mechanism, and often people are not drinking for another reason, a health reason. So it's a complicated one. There are some anti-inflammatory properties of alcohol that have got cardiovascular benefits, and animal models have shown that there are benefits of alcohol in light, in sort of low levels of consumption. And it does come out over and over again in the literature that light alcohol consumption. So that's probably the NH and MRC guidelines are no more than 2 drinks a day. So light drinking seems to be protective. Diabetes increases your risk. Depression increases your risk. So obviously treating those disorders if you have them. High cholesterol midlife increases the risk of late life dementia, but if you have high cholesterol in late life, it doesn't seem to increase the risk. We don't understand why. Low social engagement is a risk. So the research that we've done has shown that people who have 4 or more social types of social engagements per week seem to be protected. And that can... It's a subjective type of thing, social engagement. Some people perceive social engagement differently to others, but you know, that can be with family and friends, or it can be online, some type of social engagement, what you define as that. Pesticide exposure increases the risk, and this has been shown in people who have occupations that expose them to pesticides, so people that, you know, crop sprayers, people like that. We don't know about domestic pesticide use. There hasn't been enough research done on it. Having a high body mass index, so being overweight or obese in midlife, increases your risk of late-life dementia. So to be overweight, you have to have a body mass index of over 25. We've also found that being very underweight increases the risk, but very few people are underweight because the technical definition of underweight is a BMI of less than 18.5, which is extremely rare. We've looked at it in our big studies, and there's virtually nobody once you hit 40 who's that slim, unless they're very, very ill. So in late life, being overweight doesn't seem to increase your risk of dementia. We don't understand why. There's something called the obesity paradox. A lot of things for older people, once you're sort of in your 70s and 80s, being overweight doesn't seem to carry the same risk as it does for when you're younger. So if you're young, if you're overweight at my age, it increases your risk of dementia when you're older. But if you're overweight when you're older, it doesn't seem to carry as much risk, and we still don't know why. Protective factors. The best thing that you can do is be physically active. So in the past, we thought that when your brain finished developing, say, you know, in your 20s, early 20s, that was it. You had a fixed number of brain cells, and I was taught that when there's a lot of research saying education is protective, and I'm really all for lifelong learning, but particularly keeping kids in school. So the biggest thing we could do to reduce international rates of dementia would be to increase level of education in developing countries. I just thought I'd show you this picture quickly because I think many of you may have heard people say things like, healthy heart, healthy brain. So Alzheimer's Australia, in all of their public awareness campaigns that I've contributed quite a lot, talk about the link between cardiovascular risk factors and brain health. And if you have a health, you look after your heart, you look after your brain. And people go, yeah, that's right. Yep, I agree with that. But I think if you look at this picture, you understand why. The brain is actually full of blood vessels. So if you look after your vascular health in your body, you're looking after your brain. So this picture basically says it all. It's a real vascular organ in your brain. So some of the intervention work that we've done, we've just finished a randomised controlled trial of online risk reduction for Alzheimer's disease, trying to find a low-cost way of getting people to change their behaviour to reduce their risk. And this is in middle-aged adults in their 50s. We have all different components in the trial. We look at nutrition, social engagement, depression. It's three or more servings of fish per week, which is protective. For stroke, it's even less. It seems, I think it's one or two servings of fish a week reduce your risk of stroke quite significantly. So it's very easy to increase your fish intake. Evidence around what people can do to optimise their brain and their cognition throughout, not just in old age, but through adulthood. I've nearly finished. I just wanted to tell you a little bit about public policy. So, as I said, there's no point just doing research and having it sit in academic journals. So what I've tried to do is, with the research, get it out there, go and talk to people, advise, be in advisory roles. We've advised, do a lot of advising for Alzheimer's Australia. I've been the chair of the medical and scientific panel. I'm now on the board of directors of Alzheimer's Australia and can advise on their public awareness campaign. I've been on the Ministerial Advisory Council on Ageing in the ACT here and advising on the Older Persons Assembly that we're having this year. There's other roles that someone in my situation can take. You're often invited to contribute or to advise on committees and panels. I've advised the Human Rights Commissioner about older drivers, trying to provide some evidence about what we actually know from science. It's a very emotive area, and often these people need to know what the science says, and the NRMA and their policies on older drivers. So the future is really in my area, as you can see. Dementia is a huge problem. We're looking at trying to prevent or delay dementia. We can save an enormous amount of suffering and also a lot of money by even delaying dementia for 5 years. To optimise how well people they function over their adult life course, so that reduces the decline. And what we talk about is cognitive capital. So in this room, if we looked at the cognitive capacities of everybody here, we could call that our cognitive capital that we have. And in ageing, we're losing that cognitive capital. So with that, William Uttermolen, he had, you know, artistic capital that he lost through Alzheimer's disease. And so what we want to do with it as an ageing population is retain as much of that capital, as those skills and abilities that older adults have or that all of us have as we age. And that's a much more positive way of looking. So we want to prevent dementia on the one hand, but we also want to increase or grow our cognitive capital and maintain that as long as possible. So what we want to do, and this is my research centre at the ANU, is find ways that people can age well, and that's in whatever circumstance you find yourself in. So if you have dementia, how can you age as well as possible? If you have a disability, what ways, how can we discover through science how people can age as well as possible? And that's all. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Karen, for a very wonderful presentation. It was lovely to have your personal story woven in with such really interesting, practical information. We do have some time for questions. I'll take the mic to you if you don't mind putting up your hand. Thank you.
Thank you for an excellent talk. I just wondered, with dementia patients, there's clearly a lot, as we know, with confusion and the different ways that the patients react, but some are quite volatile and can be aggressive, whereas others seem to be very calm and accepting. Is there research into why different people react in different ways?
So with dementia, it depends which part of the brain is affected by the pathology. Some can affect your personality. There's a lot of distress and problems with communicating. Often we find someone with dementia is actually in pain, and what's seen as difficult behaviour is actually the fact the person has a broken bone or some sort of other health problem. There is a lot of research into that area, and a lot of, we call them behavioural and psychological problems, BPSD. So, yes, there's a lot of concern and work in that field.
Hi, Karen. Your drivers with dementia, are you saying that people can drive for longer with dementia?
Good question. I do a lot of research into normal ageing and driving, so we're trying to optimise how well normal people can drive. With dementia, everybody with dementia will have to give up driving. You can drive in the early stages with dementia. Depending on the type of dementia, in the early stages, a lot of people can still drive, but there will be a time when they'll have to give up driving. In the early stages of dementia, people can actually be quite well a lot of the time, and they can just have, often in the late afternoon, they get very tired and their concentration is affected then.
I'm just wondering, when you're going to write a book about ageing, there are so many books written about, here's your baby, this is what you do, or you're expecting your baby, this is what you do.
Yeah.
The child is growing up, there's the teenager, there's all this stuff. But when you get to 60, you go to the doctor and say, look, you know, there's something strange happening to me here. Oh, yes, well, that's to be expected because you're getting old. And now at 85, I've had 25 years of this.
Yes.
And I'm finding it very difficult to really understand with what's going on with my body and my mind. So I thank you very much for explaining about Alzheimer's, and I certainly will switch on to that page on the net. And I'm also wondering if you're associated with what's going on with the ASPRI program at Monash University.
I'm very much aware of ASPRI, but I'm not involved in the ASPRI project. As for writing a book, I've thought of writing a book. I just need to find 6 months in my schedule to do it, and a collaborator. I've got a collaborator in Denmark who'd quite like to do that, but it's the time to take to do it that's the problem, yeah. I think I agree. I think it would be very useful.
This may not be quite the subject of your talk, but what is it that generally kills people with Alzheimer's?
That kills them? It's probably like most things, it ends up being a complication of, a complication of the disease. There's problems with feeding and swallowing, just general bodily breakdown, the flu, heart disease, yeah.
Thank you very much for a great talk, Karen. My mother had Alzheimer's and my father had Parkinson's. And I found the process of being with them in the last years of their lives not just painful, often wonderful, but also fascinating, absolutely fascinating to see the processes that they went through, and that they were not giving up at all right at the end. The day before my father died, when the rest of us were on our stumps, he was saying, I'm not ready to give up yet.
Yeah.
So one of the question I wanted to ask you is Australia worse at ageism than other countries? Because my perception is that we are a profoundly ageist culture and that other countries are aware that in age we have wisdom, experience, all sorts of wonderful things that younger people have too. But here we... Ageism's barely even mentioned as an issue.
We are incredibly ageist. I think a lot of countries are very ageist. There are countries that are less ageist than us and have different language, different words for older people, and older people are valued as for their wisdom and knowledge. So yeah, I think it's a real problem. I know that the Human Rights Commission is very aware of it too, and that there's a growing awareness of ageism with the fact that we have a commissioner, an age discrimination commissioner in Australia is a big development here. I agree. I think we are an incredibly ageist country. We're not the most ageist, but we're up there, I'd say, with... idolising youth and undervaluing what older people have to offer. But also I think there's a fear of ageing, and what you said about dementia and the fact that you found it fascinating. We have a fear of illness and disability and death and disease, all of those things. We're very removed from it in our culture. And I think if you spend time with someone with a neurodegenerative disease or who's very ill and interact a lot with them... all disappears. They're just a person. And that's sort of all those stereotypes and assumptions that their life is worth less than anybody else's just go.
Karen, my question is about dementia and social isolation.
Yep.
It seems I looked at a website the other day from the ABS on the demographics in Australia, and something like 25% of houses are one person.
Yeah.
So it seems like it's on the rise. Are there any creative moves afoot here or around the world looking at more social ways of looking after people with dementia? I'm thinking of housing and care because sometimes the prospect of a nursing home looks a bit, not all that great. But I read about countries like Holland, for example, that are looking at more group housing.
This isn't my area of expertise, but there definitely are some wonderful innovations in housing for people with dementia in Europe. The way we've designed our buildings, the built environment is very isolating in Australia. We don't think in terms of community living, unless it's always just your family that you live with, not with other people. And that's going to become an increasing problem with an ageing population and for people with dementia here. But I think there are sort of some forward thinkers. There's architects that specialise in this area. There's been innovations internationally, but it's a matter of trying to... When there are new developments and new suburbs, and it's really getting in at the town planning stage. It's a bit like ageism. A lot of this is changing our thinking about what's possible and what's acceptable in terms of housing and living situations for people.
Now we'll just have two more questions, one here and one here.
Yes, I want to follow up on the ageism question because I think we need to be very clear about whether we're looking at ageism or sexism. Thinking of doctors, medicos, I mean, of all GPs and all sorts of specialists are among the worst offenders. And I think from them it's more often sexism than ageism. I come in and out of a doctor's surgery and I think, would they do that to a man? No. I've been dyeing my hair silver for a bit over 10 years now, and so I've been thinking about this for about 10 or 15 years. So I'm actually very keen to know if you have any sort of plans or program already in place for getting the message across to medicos?
Unfortunately, no, I don't have any specific programs to address sexism or ageism. I mean, I deal with both myself. I think sexism is just as bad as ageism, and it's something I think we were chatting about this before the session this morning, saying how little has changed for women. Often professionally, I'm often end up being the only woman on a committee or a board or whatever. And I guess for older women, you've got both sexism and ageism together. Older men have their own issues as well, so I think you have to be careful there. So I think it's both. I guess it's about tolerance and, again, I think these need to be addressed at a public policy level and by public figures, people that have influence and trying to set up a different expectation and different stereotypes. It's not something that is a quick fix. They're issues we've been grappling with for decades, well, you know, forever. But I think the... I mean, it's interesting, once you start talking about women's issues, people have perceived that there was all this change, and then often if you start looking at the statistics, actually they haven't changed as much as we think they have.
Karen, first of all, I picked up a book, 101 Ways to Prevent Alzheimer's, and a friend asked me if I could remember where I put it. as one that... at the moment, during retirement in my 70s, I'm public officer for the Tuggeranong Community Council, covering also community and health, and as an ex-nurse career, etc., and running, setting up and running care for the aged, etc. Now, I have been very interested in the UK team that looked at, excuse me, first of all, octogenarians in Georgia, of course, then Japan, and then, of course, the little island of Greece that they discovered there were even more, and they went to look at why. They were quite exhausted, the team, because they couldn't keep up to them.
Yes.
Actually.
Yep.
They are very, very interesting, and so that was very good to look at. Also, the work of Philip Day, who's a UK medical journalist and researcher, working with... Nobel Peace Prizes, PhD, and he is, and the first thing he states, first thing you do when you wake up in the morning is to have a very large glass of water, because the brain actually drains water at night, through the night, etc., and that gets it straight back to your brain, and some just ordinary types of food, and particularly the hearts of celery and sage, marvellous for memory. So you don't have to look at pharmaceutical drugs. There's a lot out there as let food be your medicine. And so that's the sort of thing that I take up with our Tuggeranong community. And, of course, there's 17 suburbs, 98,000 people. So it's very interesting to look at alternatives. And thank you very much. You're doing some wonderful work.
Thank you.
Thank you once again, Karen. That was a wonderful presentation. Please join me. Well, firstly, thanking Karen and thank yourselves for...
Yeah, thank you.
Ticking off your engagement and cognitive activities for this week. All right. Morning tea is ready in the lounge, I believe, so please let's make our way there.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.